Okay, so it's now 6 minutes after two. So I suggest, can you hear me? Okay.
Yes. Hi.
Perfect. So thank you everyone for being here. Some people will arrive in this room as well in a few minutes. Thank you very much for everyone for coming today and being with us in this session of the Center for Inter-Society Seminars. Today we are very, 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 very happy to welcome Bernard Gergen, which is a very good friend and colleague of mine who works at King's College London and who is a great historian of technologies and digital technologies in particular. Bernard will talk about how what we often believe is something that is very typical to our sort of present day, the way in which screens, like the screens of our computers or our phones capture our attention all the time, is actually something that might have started, at least I was surprised, you know, far before that I thought it would. And it might have started not so much in the commercial attention economy kind of settings to which we generally make reference when we talk about this kind of screen distraction or screen attraction, but in some other social technical context. And with that, without further ado, I give the floor to Bernard, who, as we often do, would speak about 15, 20 minutes, then we'll take a little break for questions and answer, then another discussion, and then a final Q&A. Bernard, the floor is yours. And thank you very much for being with us.
So thank you so much for the generous introduction. Thank you for the invitation to speak today. Je vais parler en anglais. Malheureusement, il y a autrefois, j'ai parlé français assez bien, mais j'ai beaucoup oublié. Alors, je vais parler aujourd'hui en anglais et merci pour la patience avec mon anglais. You know, my training is very much, on one hand, and very kind of rigorous, detail-oriented archival histories of technology, and then also certain kinds of critical and comparative analysis that you might find in literary studies or critical theory. So normally when I talk, you know, I do these very dense, I read the paper line by line and try to make everything perfect. Today, I'm trying something a little different. I'm gonna try to talk a little more freely and just kind of unpack the ideas in a more open way. So I hope that, I hope that works. Let me share my screen. Advanced portion of screen, share. moment. Slideshow, hold on. Slideshow, presenter view. Okay. And you know, just to say, so you know, as some of you may know, I've been kind of in conversation with Tommaso almost 20 years now, from when we studied together in Paris. A lot, and you'll actually see at the background of this talk, a lot of kind of concerns that he and I were talking about in different ways 15 years ago, right? Both on one hand, what it is to understand digital media as a mapping technology, right? And when I say mapping, I mean literally physical space, to be sure. But I also have in mind something like we are what are mapped by digital technology. And in a way, our psychologies, our mental states, our engagement, you know, these are all in a way mapped and channeled by digital media. And so there's an attempt here to give a kind of history, right? So I'm calling this talk an archaeology of digital attention, radar, war, and the birth of ubiquitous vigilance. Hold on, let me just, and the argument in kind of broad sweep is that attention is historically specific. It comes out of not just what's in our heads, but a kind of chain of relations that's organized between human and non-human elements, right? So it could be humans and technologies, it could be humans and writing. It's generally social and it's networked. I would say even old-fashioned kind of pre-digital forms of attention have some collective element to them. And they're usually, the way we practice attention is shaped by moments of crisis. They could be spiritual, political, or economic, which then get disseminated to other spheres. So part of the argument today is that the attention we're dealing with today is very specific to our digital ecosystems. That it's not just that when we use digital ecosystems, it's not just that digital ecosystems require attention for them to work, but in a way, our attention is designed into digital networks for very specific historical and political reasons. And our attention is shaped by these digital networks. Okay, if you go to the extreme end of this, and I'm not gonna go into all the technical details, the very temporality of computing is organized around a problem of attention, right? But what I mean is, so in the 1950s and the 1960s, you see the invention of things like magnetic core memory, right? So this is a magnetic memory that where computers can process things instantly. And you have also the invention of touchscreen technologies, computer graphics, real-time digital communications. And all of these were meant to allow a kind of real-time instantaneous feedback between humans and their computing machines, right? And so the manner in which computers process data, the speed at which they process, the manners in which they present it are partially devised and invented to respond to the needs of a human user. And as I suggested earlier, a particular type of political crisis. So I'm going to make a few notes on how the kind of attention that we know today, how it started to be invented, and its, you know, position within our digital ecosystems. So a few kind of very general background remarks, and I'm speaking in broad generality, so, you know, forgive the imprecision at moments, right? There's a couple of ways we could think about problematizing attention, making attention something we could think about and discuss and debate. You know, just schematically, I've suggested you could have a kind of non-critical view of attention. So attention and its corollary distraction, you can imagine them as some more or less biological and sociological fixed qualities that, you know, we have to confront today because they relate to the world we live in. But, you know, attention and distraction are set and determined. Then you have a kind of semi-critical view. And it's maybe a little bit of an unfair description, but nonetheless, so someone like Georg Franck, who's written, you know, very seminal works about the attention economy. Part of his concern is that attention is an economic problem and it should be studied for purposes of generating revenue. And, you know, attention itself also can be kind of managed and shaped. So, you know, there's a little bit of a critical purpose, a critical angle on attention there. There's another view, right, that we would associate with something like the Frankfurt School, people like Walter Benjamin, Siegfried Krakauer, for whom attention is a historical and culturally variable entity. And one of the things that our task as critics to do is to track its emergence and consider possibilities for its realization. Like, you know, the critical view here is also aimed to a kind of potential liberation. You know, for example, Krakauer, the film theorist, sociologist, talks about how in the 1920s and the 1930s, Berliners were said to be obsessed with distraction. And Benjamin develops a very similar theme when he looks at the 19th century Paris arcades, the way that people just want to go into the streets to be distracted by a whole set of a phantasmagoria of commodities, right? And Krakauer in particular says, you know, this is a little bit moralistic. We're looking down on distraction as if it's some kind of moral failing. And he says, you know, what we should understand about this attention is that industrial attention or industrial distraction is also a counterpart to industrial attention. That is, under modern working conditions, particularly in factories or sitting at desks, you know, we have to focus our bodies, our minds for long periods of time. And then when we come outside of the workplace, we want a certain sort of release. So in a way, when the Frankfurt School kind of does their kind of critical analyses of distraction and the place of distraction in capitalism, they're also trying to kind of develop a new revalorization. They're trying to say, well, the distraction is actually, it has a purpose, but its purpose is part of a particular industrial order. And we want to think about other kinds of uses of the attention, not just say, hey, people need to straighten up and focus on what's in front of them. I added another point to this, partially in a gesture towards some shared background Tommaso and I have, which is there something like maybe an actor network or cyborg theory of attention? By cyborg, I mean Donna Haraway's. And if there is, that's in some ways what this talk is moving towards. This is a notion of attention as something that's fashioned in chains and networks, right? That it's a relay between humans and instruments, ongoing systems of translation and figuration. You could say, again, speaking with Donna Haraway, this is a cyborg theory of attention because it's not exactly about, it's certainly not about some biological body. And it's not exactly about a well-defined, humanist subject. It's rather about these networks and relays through which, for example, something like attention or vigilance emerges. As a tendency, that's the kind of problematization of attention I'm giving today. So the claim in broad scope here is that digital ecosystems, they realize a regime of attention that more or less is a product of military fashioning, particularly in World War II and the Cold War. And one of the things that I think is very important is that early digital systems, digital networks of the 1950s, 1960s were designed as ecosystems. They were designed as recursive systems of command and control. And arguably, there's a larger case to be made for this, arguably, they were the kind of first real hardcore application of ecological systems theory, right? Because there have been all these ideas of electrical systems in the previous decades, but the designers of things like Project Whirlwind, an early radar system for the US government in the 1950s, they developed accounts of human machine interaction and how they would sustain themselves in a kind of feedback network, or you could say a cybernetic system. Mm-hmm. And so one implication of this is that, the attention that arises out of the system, it has definitely geopolitical aspects and it has technological aspects. I'm not gonna get into theological elements, but I think that's there too. And the attention is basically, you have the rise of jets and massive firepower in the course of the 20th century, particularly things like atomic weapons. Okay, when this happens, you have a new type of breakdown between, for example, the home front and the war front, between spaces of peace, spaces of war, such that you need both new systems of constant vigilance, constant attention to kind of define and police the borders of the state. And because it's on such gigantic scale, you need new systems of machines to largely sustain that. And that is why you start developing digital networks, which is to say 1940s computers, they're largely machines that sit in the room. 1950s and 1960s computers increasingly start becoming networked across broad territories for real-time communications. So I have, one thing that's tricky about this is it's very, very hard to get a grasp today on how much the rise of things like jets and atomic warfare transformed senses of space and time on planet Earth and transformed problems like vigilance, the problem of paying attention to things, okay? So I have this clip from a movie, from a TV show that aired on American television in the 1950s, just to get a kind of concrete grasp of how was the state talking to the populace, the American citizenry in the 1950s about the problem of being alert, of paying attention, and the prospect of an endless Cold War. Hopefully this video will play.
You know, it's been almost 200 years now since that famous night when Paul Revere looked up into the church tower there in Boston and saw the lantern which signaled to him the approach of the enemy. Now, in the period of time since then, there have been a great many changes, but the one change that has been most important to all of us is the fact that today our two oceans, one on either side of the country, are no longer barriers to a sudden surprise attack. Now, let's watch this. Now, this is an enemy bomber. Now, what we saw there could happen to any of us. Fortunately, it is the responsibility of the United States Air Force to prevent such disasters. The old lantern of Paul Revere's time has given way today to such modern things as the electronic eye, which sweeps the sky both by day and by night to prevent the arrival of any unwelcome intruder. So let's look now at our all-important radar defense screen. To tell us of this, we are privileged to have as our guest on Science in Action, Brigadier General James W. Andrew, United States Air Force. Welcome to Science in Action, General Andrew.
Thank you, Dr. Harrell. I'm glad to be here. I'd like to point out that while the Air Force is responsible for air defense, it's such a big job, of course. Many people have seen that and perhaps have seen other things in other parts of the country that look like...
Okay, so I'm going to stop there, but after that, he starts explaining the organization of the emerging radar defense system in 1950s America, and how you have a constant system of electronic surveillance to prevent this, you know, it's comical, but it's quite serious. This vision that opens the scene where they're saying, you know, this is a live television broadcast to the American public. At any time, you can all be incinerated. At any time, you can all be annihilated. And they said it in this very interesting kind of political arc, right, between the time of the American Revolutionary War, when this fellow Paul Revere was said to have warned against the British. And they say, you know, now we have a new set of geopolitical ratios, and we need a new form of vigilance, and that will come from electronics. Now, this form of vigilance has a lot of peculiar aspects to it. I would try to say as a first step, you know, I want to, again, try to historicize it, try and set it in a longer network of thinking about vigilance and attention, for example, in the English-speaking world, right? So in 1790, you have this Irish statesman who says, speaking in Dublin, the condition upon which God hath given liberty to man is eternal vigilance. Okay, and you have a slight variation on that about 50 years later with the US President Andrew Jackson, who says when he's leaving office, eternal vigilance by the people is the price of liberty, and you must pay that price if you wish to secure the blessing. Now, there's a couple of things that are interesting about this, right? These notions of, you know, vigilance is a more old-fashioned word for attention. Vigilance is particularly has a kind of religious and theological connotation. You could have practice vigil over a body, for example, when someone has died. But vigilance in this context, it has a link, for example, to theology, it has a link to God, but it also has a link to an emerging set of democratic ideals. Right. So when as they're trying to fashion a new type of liberal democratic state, particularly in the 19th century, they say in order for the democratic state to function, you need a citizenry that will constantly be engaged, constantly be paying attention and constantly be watching for threats, both from domestic and abroad. So someone like Andrew Jackson, you know, famously, he's a real, commits mass genocide against Native Americans in North America. And so when he's talking about we need to practice vigilance, he means both against, for example, would-be foreign enemies, Native Americans, foreign nations, and he also means vigilance of the politicians themselves. And he says that is how you secure liberty. And that liberty is a blessing. So when you talk about something like vigilance in the 19th century, it is a thoroughly political concept. It is also a deeply religious concept, okay? I'm setting some of the, I'm not so actually interested in the 19th century, but I'm trying to sort of set the backdrop for how it really changes in the course of the 20th century of what it means to not just practice vigilance, but to practice something a little different, attention. So Marshall McLuhan, you know, writing in the 1960s, looking at the threat of perpetual fear of nuclear annihilation, has a slightly different analysis. He says, with regard to the bomb and retaliation as deterrent, that is mutually assured destruction, we'll all blow each other up if a war ever breaks out, it is obvious that numbness is the result of any prolonged terror. The price of eternal vigilance is indifference. You know, McLuhan was famously a kind of, a lot of what he says are sort of quips and jokes. If you push too hard on the quote, it tends to kind of break apart a little bit. But what he's pointing towards is that the problem of attention, the problem of vigilance in the Cold War was very different from that of the 19th century, right? Because in a sense, the perpetual vigilance that was promoted by democratic theorists in the 19th century was not exactly perpetual, and it certainly was not everywhere at all times, right? It was a selective exercising of critical attention to, you know, local, more or less identifiable threats. By the 1960s, this quote says 1994, it should say 1964. By the 1960s, you actually have a completely different problem, which is that of, as he says here, prolonged terror. Perpetual ongoing threat of complete annihilation. And out of that, there's a way where vigilance itself starts getting flattened out, right? So Karl Marx famously talks in the 19th century about capitalization annihilating time and space. I think one way you could think about that is as you have a thoroughly instrumented global technical space, vigilance as something differentiated breaks down to something, a kind of more diffuse imperative or exhortation to attend to threat at all times. And it's closely associated with these new forms of electronic monitoring systems that are taking shape in the 1950s and 1960s that we saw in that initial. Here's another way you could kind of put it. I mean, just to think, you know, we're all sort of more or less aware on some, to some degree, conditions of pandemic work, conditions of constantly being online and remote are extremely exhausting, extremely demanding. It is, you know, it's very, very hard to constantly be engaging around screens. And I think this is partially what McLuhan is gesturing towards. So starting in the 20th century, you start developing new technical systems to give shape and order to vigilance. I would even say to start turning vigilance into a more neutral technical object that can be modulated like attention. So here's one example of early projects to kind of give shape to the practice of vigilance and attention in a kind of technical system. So this is a diagram of a battleship from the 1910s, an American battleship. And in the 1910s, when you had battle at sea, you suddenly were dealing with a situation that you could be firing at ships that were at, you know, could be, you know, 5, 10, 15 kilometers away. You could even be firing 20 kilometers away. You couldn't necessarily see your threat. You also had this strange problem that it took a certain amount of time for your ballistics, for your weapons to reach the object in a distance. So you started needing new complex human machine networks with a kind of feedback function by which you could order different, you could break attention, break vigilance down into serial technical tasks that then machines would help process some of it. So what we see here is a diagram of the ship. Across the top, you sort of see different personnel who have different forms of observation roles. And they also have different instruments to plot in what they're seeing into a machine. And then underneath it, you had a very early analog computer, the battle tracer, which would draw a picture. Here we see a close-up of it. It literally had a computationally generated image. It was drawn with pencils, which would map out where your ship was and where the enemy ship was. Okay, is it, I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. It's an extraordinary computational device. I mean, it's, I think it's the first real-time visual interface on a computational machine. That's my theory. I haven't seen anyone find in earlier examples, and this would be from 1916. So how do you make this machine work? Okay, it needs to constantly, you're dealing with multiple moving objects, you're dealing with large distances, and sometimes you're dealing with threats you literally cannot see. It needs a stream of information. And even today, machines are not actually so good at observing the environment. I mean, there are major exceptions, but generally, observing the environment involves a lot of human effort to organize and shape and the data. So here we see a few examples of how that would have worked. We have a couple, these are all instruments that would have been on the top of the ship. Okay, on the far left, you have something called a target bearing transmitter. And that's basically something where you track the movement of your would-be enemy ship. Then you have a director scope, which is measuring the movement of the ship in different ways. You have, for example, in the bottom right here, a time flight clock. The reason you would need a flight clock is because what would happen was once you targeted the ship and you aimed weaponry at it, you know, it could take 30 seconds. It could even take a minute or a minute and a half for your weaponry to reach the target. And so what you would do is you would use this time flight clock to time how long it took for the weaponry to land. And when you saw the splash, you could turn that, you could use that to measure the distance. So all of these are different ways where you're mapping things that are seen, things that are heard, into numbers that can be fed into a kind of very elementary, into this very elementary computational network that we see here, right? So early target control, World War I era warfare is fashioning a new technical system, a new network for giving shape to attention, for giving shape to observation. And, you know, I would say for turning vigilance into a more or less calculable object, right? I'm gonna talk for a couple more minutes and then I'm gonna pause. That kind of sets the stage for what becomes the real breakthrough in the invention of electronic vigilance, the invention of perpetual computational vigilance. The major moment really in motivating a new type of electronic vigilance, a new kind of electronic attention, is the Blitzkrieg in London, right? Up until the 1930s, Great Britain had a relative insulation from the enemy, right? The English Channel provided a certain distance and warning of attack. With new forms of modern flight, and also a modern flight enabled with new extraordinary powers of destruction, that safe distance collapsed, okay? All of a sudden, for the first time in its history, England has this sense that we are exposed and we can't actually watch and monitor our territory with adequate warning. So the English, working with the Americans, they develop famously radar, right? The main advantage of radar is, of course, it can see the enemy coming at a distance. It sends radio waves out into the sky. They bounce off objects in the distance. They get processed through a machine. So here we see in this picture, what you're seeing is a trailer. A trailer basically holds a lot of the key tracking equipment. You can see in the distance, you see weapons for shooting down the enemy plane. And that square that's kind of in the middle with two guys next to it, that's actually a very elementary analog computer, right? And so here we have a kind of birth, I think, a kind of original scene of electronic experience and electronic observation, right? Where what you're really learning to do is you're learning to fashion humans and machines in networks where the humans, the machines take part in observing, the humans are constantly regulating the data, they're modulating it, they're sorting the kind of signal from the noise, and generally speaking, they're working in teams. They're working in complex networks of teams such that you can have a new kind of vigilance, you can have a new kind of warning, and also the task of being perpetually vigilant starts being handed off to machines. And I'm going to pause here. Most histories of radar pay tremendous attention to the aspects of actually the radio waves themselves, right? And it seems to me that this is kind of a mistaken focus. At least it's been overemphasized. Because to me, one of the great achievements of 1940s and 1950s radar was suddenly you start developing electronic visualization. And you have this proliferation of extremely differentiated means for visualizing and mapping space. And the reason you need all these means for visualizing and mapping space is that even up to the present day, the ability of machines on themselves to target and shoot things down, it's very, very limited. You generally need human judgment to make sense of a threat, to understand what a threat is. And so these dynamic forms of visualization, here we see a different one. These dynamic forms of visualization, you know, there's different ways you can have, you can have visualizations that simply map distance. You can have visualizations that map distance and time. You can have visualizations that map a kind of whole territory. And here you start seeing what more practically what you would have in 1940s radar control was actually a set of radar operators, computational machines, electronic visualizations, and actually humans working with things like maps. And they would circulate and exchange data back and forth. Hold on one second. Adequately sight and target the enemy. I'll just show you a couple other brief images. Here we see a couple of the different layouts. Radar, there have to be at least 50 or 60 distinct different types of radar setups in the 1940s, because it's always a problem of how do you coordinate a particular terrain, a particular set of machines, a particular set of users to mapping the space, attending to it with the knowledge that even the smallest gap in attention, even the smallest gap in vigilance runs the risk of massive total destruction, right? The way you produce that is not just to have machines that can see things at a distance. You need to produce new types of users, right? So here we see some tests drawn from the 1947 book, Psychological Research on Operational Training. And these are different ways that you could train research operators to approach an image in terms of discrete elements that could be mapped and individually manipulated, right? So on the left, for example, you see a photograph. The photograph has numbers and letters. And the question was, if you look at the photo above and the photo below, how quickly can you figure out where those two images below relate to the image above? You needed to be able to take a continuous image and break it down into discrete quadrants. Along with that, you had various ways for training the hands to modulate the apparatus. You had various other ways of training the observation itself. And out of this, you produce a new type of user who could attend to the scene, could attend to the world around them with a particular type of precision, right? And out of that, you start really fascinating digital ecosystems, because for the first time, you can integrate humans and machines in a kind of real-time electronic system of feedback, because you've sort of bent the machines towards the humans, and you've also pulled the humans towards the machine, so that they have a set of comparable terms of organizing, in this case, spatial data, visual data, as discrete elements. Okay, so I'm gonna pause there. If there's any questions, and then whenever you're ready, we can talk about the Cold War and how that gets kind of disseminated on a larger scale.
So I see a question by Lionel in the chat. So I don't know, Lionel, if you want to ask it yourself, or I can read it out if you prefer.
Okay. No, this is not a question. Hi there. Thank you. Thanks for sharing this information and the really, really interesting topic. I was just wondering whether it was context dependent of the sound, the theological sound, because there is in the race for technology, there is a huge difference on the cultural and the religious background in between Europe and North America, for instance, which remains really politically engaged in religious issues. Yes. And the course for technology in Europe is not as dependent as theology. So I wanted to have your feelings about that. I'm so sorry.
So that's really interesting and helpful to me. As a general rule, you know, it's always risky to talk in generalizations, and yet I will, right? It seems to me that, you know, a lot of these electronic technologies are coming out of the United States and in the early periods in dialogue with the UK, with United Kingdom. And as a tendency, behind this, there's a political and theological notion of vigilance that has a kind of Protestant quality to it. It's all about individual responsibility, right? And I hesitate to make broad sweeping distinctions between, for example, German or French context, but nonetheless, it's built, I'd put it this way, it's built in a theory of the subject that is highly, highly individualistic in the American context and the British context. And I think that has Protestant orientations, although it can't be entirely reduced to that. I suspect that if you looked in kind of continental context, you might have a different sense of collective responsibilities of vigilance. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But of course, in parallel, the very idea of subjectivity and even the cultural model of individualism is quite mm-hmm. different from the North American context. Even if different countries in Europe and North America are all labeled as modern, yes, right? Yes. And this is the path of the modern individual, reflexive, so on. But you pinpoint something really interesting. Because it brings about a long discussion on the, let's say, cultural model of the subject and the embeddedness in society and on the background, the political and technological issues, I guess.
I mean, I completely agree. You know, the part of the reason I like that kind of weird 1950s TV show is this pointing towards like someone like Paul Revere, this guy who, you know, was supposed to have ridden his horse and told everyone the British were coming. You know, it's all about a kind of ideal political subject who's an individual, who's heroic. And this, in some ways, this actually creates complicated problems for the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s forms of attention, because in order to defend a massive territory, you need collective mobilization, right? My suspicion, this is highly speculative. I couldn't certainly prove it at this instance, right? One of the things that's interesting about McLuhan is, you know, McLuhan was a devout Catholic, he was a very conservative Catholic. And so he famously, for him, the difference between electronic media and what came before was that, you know, he talks about the Gutenberg galaxy, this rise of book culture that atomizes individuals. And I think the reason he's so interested in these electronic networks that fashion so-called global villages and so forth is because it's a new type of kind of administrative system for binding collectives that I think appeals to aspects of his Catholic worldview. I know that's very rough and that's very generalistic, but so I think part of what you do see here is a kind of struggle back and forth in the 40s and 50s and 60s, because the Brits and the Americans want to have this highly individualistic subject, but that individualistic subject of democracy, of defense, is totally inadequate to the actual problem that's emerging, right?
Thank you very much. That was a really interesting discussion. Are there any other questions in the audience? Otherwise, I do have one as well. First, if someone else wanna ask a question, please go ahead. So otherwise, my question is, and if you plan to talk about it in the next part of your talk, please just say that, because you might. I'm really, really, it's so interesting the way in which the kind of attention that you just described and the way in which it was constructed as a socio-technical system, I very much agree with that, is also very, very different from another type of attention that was almost in the same year, well, in the same years, I would say, being also constructed through the mass media, radio first and then television, which is also an attention that it, you know, to some extent it has the same, some similar features. It's also something that is supposed to be continuous, right? Yeah. You should leave, you know, at least from a certain point on, you are supposed to leave your TV or radio on all the time, but it's also a very casual attention, yeah, right? Yeah. So it's something, you know, you do other stuff, and then you also listen a little bit, and they all, you know, so they all, beginning of the electronic advertisement, like this soap, kind of the soap advertisement, with the becomes symbiosis with the soap advertisement and soap opera, which you know you're supposed to be able to listen why as a woman in the house, you're doing, you know, chores. So do you think these two types of attention, do you think they're separated, or do you think in some way they also sort of interact and interfere one with the other?
So I think it's both. So the rise of, you know, I take very seriously the fact that radar is radio. I wouldn't use the word broadcasting, but you could. It's a form of it's very similar as a technology to radio and television. And so the way I think of this, right, and in a way, this is a resistance to technology. It's all about technology, and it's a resistance to technological determinism, because the technology, I think a techno-social system is a much more useful concept than a medium, right? If you point to this or that technology, it's hard to explain some of the changes that are happening in public mentality, public attention, right? What's interesting is that what radar, television, and radio, in a way, they all participate in this totally bizarre dissolution of space. Right. The most uncanny thing about broadcasting, radio and television is that it erupts from inside your home. You have this technical system that can just whoop, project itself into the house. And it's easy. It's kind of easy to forget. That was totally weird and bizarre and a little bit unsettling. There was something unsettling about that. Happening around the same time with the rise of jets, with the atomic weaponry, is also a similar kind of breakdown of the borders of the state as being, you know, distance and whatever. And so in a way, what I see, and in a way, atomic weaponry itself embodies this new ability to completely break apart all kind of physical matter. And so in a way, I think people watching these, learning about these things, sitting at home watching TV in the 1950s, okay, it's pressing upon them a problem that they already sense in the way in which the home itself has been broken up by technology, has been kind of invaded. And then you have the important distinction, which is sort of what this psychological testing is pointing towards, right? The bottom line is no one can really pay attention all the time. It's really, really hard. And electronic media is in some ways better as a wallpaper, something in the background. So you start mobilizing all of these means, like interactive graphics, for example, touch screens, new types of sounds that will actually mobilize and engage and pull human attention towards an immediate threat. And then as they do it, interactivity is key, because the interaction keeps the user engaged. And then you literally have a kind of continental command control system. So in a way, what you're, I'm gonna just kind of give away the argument of the talk, and then we can see if what I say actually corresponds to it. So in a way, you know, what I'm describing is the invention of interactivity, and the invention of interactivity as a way of dealing with the problem of things like a nuclear threat. And then out of that, it gets kind of mass produced and circulated through mobile phones and other objects in the course of the 80s, 90s, and 21st century. So does that make sense? They articulate a common problem of space, but then the invention of interactivity finds a way of mobilizing the kind of attention that you don't get from a TV playing in the background.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me, yeah. At least. I think Francesca has a question, but maybe we'll do it for the end.
Yes, but I can keep it for the end. I think it can be more suitable about the end, because it's about Bernard is investigating in a historical way can say something about what is happening right now in Ukraine and stuff like that. So we can go back to that at the end.
Yeah. I mean, what I'd like. If I can just kind of preemptively thank you for the remark. I mean, this is what's, you know, it's very easy to look at history of technology in terms of a seemingly natural technological development, right? Mm-hmm. And I think actually pointing towards something like Ukraine is really crucial, right? Because actually the development of these technical systems, their deployment and their shaping is often responding to major world-shaking events of, for example, an experience of safety, of distance, and so on. And, you know, part of the argument of this is that, you know, to write the history of these technical systems, you also want to write the history of things like political crisis. And, you know, as we see in the case of Ukraine, in a very practical way, it's actually these military crises are also, for example, not just crises of like technological defense, things like problems of oil and energy, they all get kind of bundled together in the development of new technical systems, you know?
Good. So I suggest if there are not other questions, we can move on with the second part. And then leave some time for the final round of questions at the end.
In a way, this talk is an argument for the importance of the history of users, right? Not users like people have wills and desires and needs and they shape their machines, but rather that humans form part of the early digital ecosystem. So one way I like to think about this is radar as a term that Walter Benjamin uses, innervation. And by innervation, he means he's interested in the idea that in a way, new technical systems act like a kind of nervous network that permeate a territory. And you have this kind of, in a history of the 20th century is a history partially of new types of sensibilities, new types of nervousness, new types of response that are shaped in the way our technology is forms an infrastructure embedded in the environment with which we're encountering. So I'm gonna jump to a different video now. This is a video of the major American defense system of the 50s and 60s, the so-called SAGE system. The reason the SAGE system is important is it does a couple of things. So a lot of the technologies I mentioned, interactive screens, magnetic core memory, real-time digital network communications, they are all invented around this machine. And then what's particularly developed around these machines is software, right? You have this transformation from an industry of computing as programming, telling a machine how to do something, to developing software, which involves a set of protocols for users. And although the SAGE system has kind of limited success as a defensive network, it does, in the course of time, provide the kind of basic technology and training and professionals who will develop American IT. Okay, I'm gonna quickly just play a little bit of this video that shows how the system worked. This is from 1960.
The long-range radars which constantly scan the skies detect all planes in flight. The information is flashed electronically to the direction center, where the computer instantaneously makes the necessary calculations and displays its findings as tracks on the scopes of the consoles. In the air surveillance section, tracking operators monitor all traffic in the sector and quickly relay unidentified tracks to operators in the identification section who determine that the tracks are hostile. An alarm sounds in the weapons direction section. The senior director and senior weapons director size up the threat using all the up-to-the-minute information displayed before them on the scope. The defensive weapons they might use are Bomark and Nike, which are installed around the major cities, symbolized by the smaller circles. The protective range of these missiles is shown by the larger circles. Interceptor air bases, there are three of them here, are symbolized as small airplanes with letters designating their location. The hostile track appears in this manner, with symbols which tell important facts. In this case, U means no interceptors have been assigned to the track.
I'm just gonna skip forward to a couple, a little, just so you have the system, it's monitoring.
Assigns the which intercept with weapons rushing toward each other faster than the speed of sound, the slightest error can mean failure. Defending our security.
Okay, so there you get it. That's just it's hard to describe how these systems work and also to dramatize their novelty. But that video gives a little bit of a sense. So here's a visualization from the American magazine Newsweek of the SAGE system, right? So what you have is basically a whole chain of ships, ground radar, planes, this major computing center, the SAGE computer, missile systems, and throughout this, you also have lots of human observers, right, who are gathering information and they're feeding it into a network that in the first instance could well be regional, for example, the northeastern part of the United States. And then gradually it forms part of a national continental wide system. Here you have a slightly different set of visualizations of how the pieces interact. And at the center, holding this whole thing together, you saw a little bit in that image, is a new type of interactive computing device. It is a touchscreen device. It's a device that has audio feedback the screens, you can do things like you can zoom in and you can zoom out. There's a telephone, so you can, for example, call your commander. Interestingly enough, and I think this is a sign of what I meant, keep in mind, these things had to be monitored 24 hours a day. It even had things like ashtrays on it, right? Because that's actually part of fashioning a proper technology for the user, that guys could sit around and smoke for hours and hours on end. There's another history actually of how this type of mapping activity in World War II was largely done by women. It gets taken up by men in the 50s and 60s. I'm not gonna say a lot about that, but that's why I say you had guys sitting around smoking, because women were removed from the role largely in the course of the 1960s. Here you see a slightly different setup of it. So what you're seeing here on the left is, for example, the main control room. On the left is the main control room that would collect information from all across different centers and present a kind of global view, for example, of the North American defense situation. Here we have a slightly different view. And when you talk about the design of this thing, there are even very peculiar things. So you see this blue lighting on the right. The reason you have this kind of blue lighting was because there was psychological research that suggested particular type of lighting both was better for maintaining human engagement and also helped make the screen more visible, right? So the designing of this involved going into it is kind of physiological knowledge, technical knowledge, visualization knowledge. And this whole system is meant to deal with the fact that you need people to act in crisis and at the same time, typically go months or years on end doing nothing. It's a very difficult problem to kind of hold together these two different aspects of it. One way that that is done is the rise of simulation research. And when I say simulation, I don't really mean like, we're modeling things on a computer. What I really mean is the construction of things like laboratories where you run experiments with human users, right? So what you see here in these pictures are simulations run by RAND's Systems Research Laboratory. So this is in the above left, this is in the above right. If you look at the image on the top left, you see all these people sitting at the top looking down. Okay, what they're looking down on is humans running a kind of simulation, right? Running, doing role-playing, that's the word for it, right? So they would build radar defense systems and they would see how do people coordinate? How do they work together? How do they solve problems? And one of the things they found that was actually super interesting, in moments of crisis, human attention shoots through the roof. People are actually super good at attending in moments of crisis. And more than that, they're extremely good at teamwork. Okay. So if you just under normal circumstances with everyone sitting around, it's actually really, really hard to keep everyone on the same page. But as soon as you presented them with the notion that Soviets are coming to, blow up New York City, you actually had a kind of sociological and psychological transformation that ran through the entire group, okay? And so out of this research, you get a couple of different things. You get a logic for designing the 1950s and 1960s radar defense system. You get an early model of how to design, for example, users for digital machines. And you also have this entire proliferation of new types of sociological research, right? So if you go to like 1950s sociology and psychology, people like the cognitive psychologist George Miller, even someone like someone that I imagine Tomasa would also be interested in, Harold Garfinkel, right, of ethnomethodology fame, they all pass in some greater or lesser extent through these systems of research that are studying and analyzing human practice as part of enchained technical networks, right? And you can kind of find the fingerprints, I would argue, of 1950s defense planning in Harold Garfinkel's approach to ethnomethodology. That's another story. So what you're seeing is not just a technological mobilization, but also a new mobilization of psychological knowledge, a new model of sociological knowledge. And you can see this if you look at 1950s and 1960s American social science. One historian talks about it as the high modern period of social science, right? The rise of behavioral sciences, very much in parallel to people like Clara Levi-Strauss, who are thinking about logical, technical, more or less mathematical systems of relations in the social body and the way they can be modeled. And it's, this kind of touches to that question earlier about the theology. A lot of Anglo-American attachment to individual heroism has to kind of dissolve in the fashioning of these systems. So out of this, you see a couple of things spin out of it. I just decided somewhat randomly to single out two very important participants in the development of these defense systems in the 50s and 60s. Ivan Sutherland, computer scientist, often called the father of computer graphics. J.C.R. Licklider, a psychologist, who were both consulting on the Lincoln Laboratory at MIT, responsible for developing the SAGE missile defense system. So in the course of the 60s, Sutherland and Licklider lay out a new set of understandings of things like graphical user interfaces that is often credited with being the backdrop for 1980s, 1990s personal computing. And the systems they develop, they're very explicit. Initially, they come out of the problem of designing users and systems in response to this particular weird threat of nuclear warfare. Being very kind of rough in general about it, what you see happens is that, so the SAGE system is it's like totally nutty. It runs like in the course of 10 or 15 years, it basically trains 70,000 people in software and programming. And then most of them go into corporate industry. And eventually they even start making their way into things like interface design. That comes a lot slower because it's so much more expensive and difficult. But they form a kind of invisible college that will dominate US thinking both in the government and in private industry for decades to come. And so now I'm gonna make some kind of big jumping leaps without drawing all the fine footnotes in hopes that maybe we can sort some of that out in discussion. And so as these kind of this new techno-social system of attention, of engagement, of teamwork, of using things like graphics and sound and constant oncoming signals to mobilize users, it gets generalized in a certain way to form what I sort of see as some of the hallmarks of the attention economy. I don't think there's a one-to-one cause effect here, right? I think there's lots of very, very important distinctions that could be drawn. But nonetheless, I also think there's a tremendous amount of continuity. Now, the continuity is sort of blurred by one major fact, at least in a context like the United States. In the 1980s and for much of the 90s, personal computing actually develops as a bunch of isolated boxes. So it kind of blinds, it creates a kind of historical gap between the systems thinking of organizing attention in the 50s and 60s, and then the mass production of computing. It's really with the rise of the internet that this networked form of attention gets mobilized in new ways. And the imperative to kind of demand of users constant vigilance, constant attention, constant response starts getting reproduced on a kind of mass scale. You know, to think about, you know, what this kind of attention means, right? To think about how it's promoted. I think a lot could be said about the thing of things like graphical user interfaces, but I would also even say things like the connection between something like a smartphone and GPS. GPS is another famous kind of Cold War US military technology for missile guidance and things like that, right? And so when cell phones are implanted, not only with these interactive graphics and sounds, but also these constant series of mapping technology, there's this ability to kind of locate spots on the planet, respond to spots on the planet, sort of divide the world up into all these individual units and manipulate them. That it's not a one-to-one map between the Cold War problem and today, but there's a kind of continuity, which that continuity becomes a little bit more clear when you compare it to, for example, 19th century concepts of vigilance. You know, at the broad scale, you know, I don't actually see this as being a psychological question. I don't even see it exactly as being about a user question. In a way, I mean, it's also about the organization of the planet itself. It's about turning the planet itself into a globally mapped system in which you can locate users and individuals into a larger expanse of observation and response, signals and response, and so on. So, hold on, let me just, to start, just to basically kind of wrap this up, in a way, I sort of imagine this as the emergence of something like not just an attention economy, but like an attention state, a state of attention that is sort of mass produced in political and industrial forms. It involves techniques of visual display meant for mobilizing attention. It's a mixture of scientific techniques for filtering both human and machine engagement. And ultimately, it's a kind of techno-scientific production of territories, right? I've, you know, randomly chosen examples from the kind of totally spooky Islington CCTV total surveillance system that is operative in London today. It's very much a kind of repurposing or reimagining of the types of observation that were happening in 1950s, 1960s with these new kind of electronic networks. As kind of one gesture towards the question earlier about broadcasting, I sort of think about this as the kind of introduction of ubiquitous screening, like screening in the sense of visual engagement, but also the kind of processing and filtering of space, of bodies, of movements. So you have something like the cell phone. The cell phone is sort of showing you the world, but it's also engaging you and plugging you into the world and shaping the type of engagement that goes back and forth. This has a certain relationship, for example, to the rise of television and broadcasting, as I suggested, but it mobilizes it in a new way. And it, you know, the extreme, I think it also actually connects in a really profound way to contemporary practices of state security and state screening, like we see in the bottom right, for example, contemporary airport screening, which is also this ongoing filtering of bodies. So this is what I mean when I say, I do see computers as essentially a mapping technology. I'm gonna just stop the sharing. I do see computers as a mapping technology. It's a mapping of space, it's a mapping of users, and it's a mobilizing attention partially to control flows in space, to police them, to regulate them. In a way, you know, the origin of this talk was really simple. The origin of this talk or this project was, I was trying to figure out why am I constantly checking my cell phone? Why am I constantly nervous? Why am I constantly looking for these signals coming in from the outside to kind of mobilize me? And so to write this kind of military history was one way of trying to grasp the modes of attention in digital ecosystems today and to grasp why attention is not just another thing in computer systems, but is actually constitutive of them, is organizing them, is part of their entire systemic coherency. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bruno. That was really, 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 really interesting. So I think Francesca now is a good moment for your question. I also have other questions, but maybe you want to go first.
Thank you. Well, I guess that in some way we have already addressed it a little bit. I just to make it a little more detailed, I was thinking about it because one of the most valuable aspects of history and the history of technology in particular, I've always found it to be when it comes to the internet, to think phenomena that are happening in recent years, by taking the long-term perspective and figuring out that things we believe to be unprecedented and deeply innovative, or maybe are not so much, or we can find patterns of behavior and on long-term phenomena such as attention. So yeah, for having tried to make sense of, for example, digital resistance as it is happening now in Ukraine with respect to the history of resistance worldwide and so on. So to try to put it a little bit in a longer term perspective, I was thinking the same thing about the ways in which what you are saying now, you just presented to us, can be useful perhaps in figuring out, for example, how dynamics of attention are at play now on both ends of the ongoing conflict, and if you have any opportunity to reflect on it, or perhaps to try and write something about it, and yeah, I would be very interested in that.
Yeah. So this is very speculative, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot. So I'm really thankful for the opportunity to address the present. It's actually a self-criticism, right? Even if we were to accept a continuity between these kind of Cold War systems and today, as soon as you start looking at the contemporary systems, you start finding, I think, in our own lifetime, tremendous differentiation, right? So, you know, the electronic visibility of Ukraine, for example, is totally different. As an English-speaking subject with an American background, it's totally different than the electronic visibility I ever experienced in relationship to Ukraine, or probably ever experienced in relationship to Iraq. Right. So famously, Iraq was the first kind of electronic cable news warfare. And all of the vision you saw of the first Iraq war on American CNN, it was like images from the fronts of missiles as they went into houses and exploded them. And it was a highly, highly machinic vision without kind of human subjects really existing in this sphere, right? And so clearly that was used to kind of mobilize American citizens' engagement and response to the war. But of course, the attention made certain things visible, targets, and it made other things totally invisible, humans, right? The Ukraine war, I've never seen anything like this, right? The whole proliferation of kind of viral videos of kind of heroic fighting and so forth, right? And so you do have this kind of mobilization of kind of, you know, in America, sometimes they would talk about kind of a citizen journalism, you know, people shooting their own videos and showing what's happening. You have this repersonalization that is on one hand, digital, individual, highly human, but can nonetheless plug into kind of global networks of communication and relay. And, you know, it's not that long since the last Afghanistan and Iraq wars. It's not like Iraq and Afghanistan doesn't have cell phone videos, right? And so in a certain regard, I do see this mobilization of attention and engagement, this turning towards things like entertainment to kind of rally a sense of risk, a sense of responsibility. But then within that, it's highly differentiated because you could say maybe in addition to a history of attention, you would also need a history of identification. And there's modes of electronic observation that disallow identification. And there's modes of a digital attention that promote identification. That's a lot of what I see coming out of the Ukraine system today. And to explain that, you can explain how digital systems make that possible, but to explain its architecture and its functioning, you need other kind of political stratagems to be referred to. Does that make sense?
I very much think so, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. We still have like 10 minutes.
Actually, so, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me? Manav, is it okay? Yeah? Okay. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. It's very stimulating, insightful to base on like a radar and military paradigm for understanding of this very long century of evolution of attention. But a very, very naive question to ask you. How would you define, and maybe to define the difference between first vigilance, second attention, and maybe three surveillance. Are we sure that radar paradigm is the only one or the best, even the best one for understanding of the complexity of attention scope? A very basic way to see that is to ask every time I'm getting a notification on my phone. I am a kind of a new attentional foot soldier or something else. And it's a way to ask in a different terms the same question that Tommaso asked to you, which means what are to you the different functions and maybe emotions related to the different devices that you studied, which means is it staying safe and have a better understanding of the different threats surrounding us are the only way to see the world through devices, or is there other things like just having fun or selling things or avoiding to getting bored or I don't know. Thank you.
So this is very, very kind of helpful and, you know, pointed, I think, signaling of some of the landmarks that would really be crucial to making sense of this story. Here's an argument. I don't know if I could prove it. but I think it's accurate. So you know, there's this graduate program in Munich. It's like Cultures of Vigilance. It's a totally interesting interdisciplinary graduate program, and it's largely focusing at kind of early modern practices of vigilance. And I think the fact that, you know, it's not only that they have contemporary research and so forth, but the fact that you have, for example, you know, early modern historians talking so much about vigilance speaks partially to the fact that my grasp of vigilance is I don't think it really belongs to a kind of totally modern sense of homogeneous, technically organized time. You know what I mean? So if today we live in an era of the industrialization of time, where it's highly, highly calculable, in a way, I think practices of vigilance, for example, if you in English, at least we would say you practice vigil next to a dead body, it's also a way of producing time, of producing space, of producing meaning. And vigilance is actually in a weird way, I think it's about a kind of time that's marked by spiritual relations. That can't really be scientifically calculated and are deeply related to things like commitments and values. Attention, the way I'm thinking about attention, the way I'm describing attention is much more in terms of what we start getting when there's a kind of scientific rationalization of both psychology and organization of time and space with industrialization. Now, that being said, the reason I point so much attention to radar is because I'm trying to signal one thing. And I think your question points toward the fact that I think whether or not this is the right thing to signal is a totally important and legitimate. It's characteristic of the temper, what's characteristic of radar attention is an ongoing sense of crisis and potential catastrophe. It's an ongoing sense of threat. And so in a way, what I see radar doing, and this is partially why I show that film at the beginning where they say, hey, look, anytime American cities can be vaporized by nuclear weapons, unless we build these new systems, it's about constantly mobilizing responses. And in a way, that kind of a constant attention and readiness for threat, although I believe that that does drive through the long history of digital networks in a profound way, I also think it goes through, for example, contemporary cable television in places like the United States, because I do think that a part of the function of cable news in the United States is to constantly get people alarmed, constantly get people worried about threats. And so, you know, I think it's absolutely true. I think fun, selling things, avoiding boredom, I think all of that would be essential to explaining like our ecologies of attention today. I think they're highly, highly differentiated. Nonetheless, I do have the sense that why is it that we need to constantly be responsive? Why is it that we constantly need to watch for, you know, alarms coming at a distance and telling, and I mean, I think this even inflects a lot of everyday workplaces. Tommaso and I have worked at similar institutions. So, you know, we could talk more about that. Surveillance, I think, intersects, but in a way, I'm gonna put surveillance on hold because I think you're right. It signals something that's a little different. And although it intersects with this story, I'm not sure I could do it justice with my already quite expansive frame and remarks I've just given to you. But I think you signal exactly the type of problem that would need to be teased out to really make this a meaningful, detailed cultural history of attention today.
I do have one which is kind of in continuity to the one you asked and the last observation you made about surveillance.
Yeah.
And it's, I was wondering, you know, when you describe this type of attention, which is idle most of the time and then has to kind of exceptionally be brought into focus, it reminded me a lot of a paper that Claudia Radu and Tobias Blanke, which you know because Tobias was at King's College, and I think he was the one who hired you, so you probably know him. They wrote this paper on artificial intelligence in the role of artificial intelligence algorithms in surveillance society, and particularly the way in which these algorithms for kind of police surveillance are built to detect anomalies. So that's what they do. The algorithm as well, now, at least for, you know, police algorithm, they tend to have the same type of attention that you describe for people looking at the radar. So they're idle most of the time, and then I have to spot this exceptional anomaly of basically now it's the terrorist rather than the nuclear threat. But it seems to me that it's a similar type of attention, now kind of automatized, but I don't know what do you think? Maybe it's a stretch.
No, I don't think it's a stretch at all. Just think about this because I think your suggestion is right on target. You know, so one of the reasons I signaled this CCTV system, the surveillance system in Islington in London, you know, one of the best urban surveillance systems, is because, you know, this is a kind of old idea in a lot of histories of media and technology. You know, whatever you build for the soldiers and for the battlefield, right? Whether it's a new type of audio tape or whether it's a new type of, you know, preservation of food. These are both famous examples from World War II. They end up being mass deployed domestically at some point or other, and they end up organizing and restructuring the home front, right? One of my mentors was Jennifer S. Light, a historian of technology at MIT. You know, she wrote this whole history called From Warfare to Welfare. And she basically says, if you look at World War II technologies, one of their major applications in the 50s and 60s in the United States was quite literally urban planning in ghettos, in, you know, typically poor African and working class African-American neighborhoods in cities like Chicago, where you tried to kind of reorganize the social body according to everything from cable technology to new ways of modeling order, right? So what you're suggesting, it sounds to me like it would fit into the kind of analysis someone like Jennifer Light made in her exploration of how war techniques become part of social policy. But I'd have to think a lot more about it too.
Sorry, there was just something that came to my mind. Do we have any other questions? Otherwise, we're moving toward the end of the time that was scheduled for this talk. But we do have a few more minutes. If there are other questions, if not, I again am very pleased to thank you. It was a great talk, really, really interesting. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much. It was honored to talk with you and to have your thoughts and feedback.
I also wanted to point it out for the people in the audience that Bernard has wrote a brilliant paper on this very topic. So go check it out.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernard.